This book, Child Psychology, is presented to you in the audio form by SheAudios.com. After listening to the audio, if you would like to further consolidate your knowledge with references, please refer to the hard copy of the book. Chapter 1, Teach the Child to Think. The sports teacher is asking the boy if he would like to join the school sports. The boy curves his lips, was thinking the same thing. No, the boy was not, because he was not let to do thinking. He was affectionately being protected from making wrong decisions by not letting him make any decisions. Teach the child the practice of thinking. Once the practice is mastered, he will then do more than thinking. He will learn and want to reflect and ponder naturally, which is not always normal with all adults. No wonder, Islam wants the believers to exercise the independence of mind in all matters in order to cultivate conviction about truth. Hark. The Quran compares those who do not think as worse than the vilest of animals. Surely, the vilest of animals in Allah's sight are the deaf, the dumb who do not think. 8:22. With the practice of thinking rooted, the mind will be prone to critical scrutiny and independent judgment. Such mind will not easily be susceptible to the outside or alien influence, especially in the present age of electronic media, which is employed to control the mind of the viewers and manipulate public opinion to suit the establishments with vested interests. With mind shielded, values remain intact and decisions pop up prompt and sound. In two hands. With the rein of mind tight in one's own two hands, the child, when adult, will not waver or be fickle in making important decisions judiciously. He will not borrow for himself decisions from others who can never put themselves squarely in his place, will never take refuge in the false safety of a status quo and leave matters unresolved, simply because to him, to take the initiative of making decision is to gamble. The passage of this life is punctuated with problems. When a problem is born, approach it to dictate your terms before it grows big enough to approach you and dictate its terms while looking down on you with your back to the wall. But that calls for an immediate and bold decision-making capacity. Good many people lack it because they, as children, were not allowed to build it up. They were not taught to think. So engage the child in the exercise of decision-making on matters that concern him, though he should fully know that the final decision is the parent's. Would he prefer a school bus with a larger seating capacity or smaller, and why? A lunchbox to the school or money for purchase from the school canteen, and why? Should he choose a desk right in front tomorrow when he, with other students, moves to a promoted class? Would he want his bed placed this way or that? These are only examples, and there arise a number of occasions for such decision-making. Result is stupendous. The result is stupendous in terms of fast thinking and self-confidence. The parents will often find the child coming up with certain requests in which there are options, and he has already considered all of them and preferred one with ready reasons, even if the reasons are weak or bad. This is true as the child grows up. A child so trained, when faced with a proposal from his teenage friends for a leisure program out, which does not seem quite all right, will say no on his own authority instead of the meek, "No, my parents will not approve of it." The exercise will naturally include the situations where the child will consider also the economic options with a view to saving money. This is because in the course of the engagement in the exercise of reasoning and decision-making, the issue of money will be surfacing, and he will have learnt in some degrees the discipline in money management. A child who has not been raised to think and therefore fails to do reasoning invites emotions to help and fill the gap. As adult, he is likely to make worse decisions for himself more through emotions than reasoning. The road to hell in this life is paved with emotional decisions. Parents fright frightens. The capacity for well-balanced thoughts in a child does not let emotions and fantasies cross the bounds. Frustration and restlessness in a person in the face of a challenge or trial can spell a disaster where success was otherwise possible from a composed mind and faith. The parents who are prone to excessive emotional reactions are bound to infect their child, who is always observant and tends to learn and copy from how the parents react in various circumstances. A tranquil mind yielding to frustration has to be only a momentary phase, and the mind is immediately recomposed. The child has to be demonstrated this by examples, even where the parents themselves are good in restraining their emotions at the time of an emergency. What often happens, however, is quite the opposite. The child continues to whimper tearfully in a state of scare, despite the reassuring words from the mother, when he sees fresh bright crimson blood still oozing under the white bandage. It is not the bleeding but the initial frenzy of fear and alarm of the mother when he cut his finger that gave him a real scare. It is quite all right for the parents to react practically the way they normally do in attending to an emergency, but strictly without showing the unnecessary or excessive emotional reaction in the presence of the child. Where valid and due, the emotions should be subdued deliberately to impart a long-term effective message to the child. It is a part of teaching the child to think. Chapter 2. Treat the child as an adult. A child on his first day in the school leaves his desk, walks to his class teacher and whispers to her something which she fails to understand until later. The child was using that funny word which was coined for him by the parents for toilet when he was a toddler. Perhaps the child, even at the schooling age, was still being soothed to sleep with the lullaby songs. He was not let to grow up mentally also. It is a real problem facing the child if he is the only child in the family. Talk to the child almost as you would to an adult. Do not underestimate his grasping power. Even if his grasping level seems low, this approach will trigger it up. It will develop at a greater pace. When the child inquires, as he would often do as any inquisitive child, about the natural phenomena or historical events or a simmering political issue or a debate raging among adults on a social or communal issue or any aspect of Islam, do not ignore him, believing that they are beyond his grasp, nor provide a cursory or simplistic explanation to reveal that you find him not worthy for a full and sincere answer. By doing so, you will be impressing upon him quite disastrously that he is mentally too far behind for this information, or that the subjects inquired are the exclusive purview of the adults and that he should not be trespassing such mental domains of others. When the child catches up as an adult, he will be having too many other new and intimate things to inquire and know about, and perhaps not any more those that he had asked about and was spurned. Is it wonder, therefore, that we have among us adults who have shallow or no knowledge about the causes of the natural phenomena? Like earthquake, volcano, eclipse, lunar vis-a-vis solar calendars, or the two world wars, or slavery, or the origin of his sect, etc. An inquisitive mind of a child is also retentive. It is a different mind when he is later in a primary school. Never ask the child to leave the adult's company in the lounge and go to his room when visitors have arrived on a courtesy call or a social visit. On the contrary, grab the opportunity by asking him to leave the recluse of his room and join the group. The purpose is manifold and the results diverse. Develops personality. Let the child witness and learn what the adults talk about and how they talk or argue. He will find that they do not interject, they do not all talk at the same time. They do not raise their voice, they do not swear. In fact, the child may find that the behavior of the visitor or visitors is refined and polished as compared to that of his parents. Do not fail to introduce him to the visitors if they are meeting him for the first time. This gives him a self-confidence and with it, develops his personality. His presence in the adult group will create in him an appetite for adult subjects. In the course of talk, create a suitable opportunity of raising a subject of the child's interest, like his studies, school, madrasa, sports, and ask him for a latest information in order to join him in the talk of the group and break the ice. Or ask him for information which will be of interest to the visitors and which you know he has. Like, what do we have for our guests, hot or cold? Or I forgot, who preached last Thursday? Or what was the subject of the preaching? In fact, there can be a number of likely current and pertinent information that the child can be asked. The psychological effect is startling. He will perceive himself a knowledgeable part of the adult group. But at the same time, do not detain him longer if the visitors are boring or the anchor types. The typical child's shyness will evaporate, paving way for the inflow of self-confidence. The child on approaching the youth age is most likely to engage in matured conversation on his own right with the adults who are a generation or two ahead. He will have broadened his horizon and enhanced his vision of what the world is all about and tailor his social interaction accordingly ahead of his age. How disturbing instead to find some parents still using that funny word coined for washroom for the child when he was a toddler. The child is not allowed to grow mentally. Live on wits. The whole purpose is to prepare the child mentally for the responsibilities of the earthly life and spiritual obligations much earlier, while others of his age are behind and in the hard way of self-preparation, so that he fares better. Remember, this is a cold, cruel world after all. Those who live on the wits of certainties and self-confidence survive better than those on the vicissitudes of chances. In about the year 1954, a public meeting was convened for the purpose of forming a tenants' association and seeking legislation to protect the interest of the tenants. When a reporter asked why a young boy of about 22 was elected to the responsible post of the secretary, the chairman of about 60 replied that the boy too came forward and spoke his mind, seeing himself equal to those elderly who spoke their mind, and that they all being equal, the big difference in his age was the plus point for his unopposed election. According to the Holy Quran, one earns according to what one struggles for. And that man shall have nothing but what he strives for, 53:39. Age is not a barrier. Parents should steer and set the child onto the fields of struggle. Taqwa is a crucial one among such fields, and whoever desires the hereafter and strives for it as he ought to strive, and he is a believer. As for these, their striving shall surely be accepted. 17:19. It is reported that in a community of boat people somewhere in a far east jungle, children are let into the water and learn to float, like adults, even before they can walk. Let me end with this note: there is little for the parents to do about the length of childhood of their children, but can do much about its width and depth. It is rightly said that men are what their parents made them. However, with regard to parental protection, the child needs it, not any less like an adult son or daughter, but in diminishing proportion to his advancing age. Overprotection is counterproductive, like a ship which the owner keeps in the safety of a harbor, but this is not what ships are built for. Chapter 3. Allow the child to speak. A prisoner misbehaving in the prison is sometimes punished by a confinement in a solitary cell. Sometimes the prisoner shouts to satisfy himself that he spoke. At least, to the wall. The human ability to speak is the Creator's blessing. To be able to speak in as many languages as possible is even a greater blessing. To prevent a person from speaking at all or for a period of time is an emotional agony. It is for this reason that a patient who is in a coma is more likely to show an eager sign of some slight response temporarily when spoken to repeatedly. Do you allow your child to speak? Speak. Indeed, he does, loud and clear, and perhaps at times incessantly, but not in as many languages as his parents speak or his grandparents spoke. And there can be no valid reasons for it, except that the parents never thought about the importance of the tradition of teaching the child all the family languages as a resplendent string of a family legacy. It is said that a child can acquire the ability to speak up to 7 languages by the age of 9 if he is faced with the necessity of communicating in those languages for his daily needs. Such is the natural propensity or aptitude for languages in a child while he is a child, and this is by the divine design of the Creator, not without a purpose. Examples of 4 languages are not rare yet in certain communities in East Africa. What does the Holy Quran reveal to us about this? And one of his signs is the creation of the heaven and the earth and the diversity of your tongues and colors. Most surely there are signs in this for the learned. 30:22. Legacy of languages. There are other communities too across the world who speak more than one language, three or four. This comes about because the parents and teachers in the communities speak with the children in the languages which the parents know. The result is a legacy of languages, in the family not for the sake of it, but for ensuring that the children, who will later find themselves, in their life on their own, are well equipped for a competitive and gainful interaction in the human society. Speaking more than one language is a social accomplishment. The slaves on their transportation across the Atlantic were laid down flat and chained together in the tiered bunks like tinned salmon, fish. They had to be brought up onto the upper deck of the ship periodically for a short spell of the essential sunshine and physical exercise. The only possible weapon they could have and of which the captain and the crew were afraid was the knowledge of more than one tribal language among the slaves. They were shipped in such groups as would comprise them of different tribes, speaking one different language so as to daunt any attempt of staging a mutiny with the precision planning and timing. This was because communication is power, the more the language media for it, the stronger the base of this power. Language as an asset. For a person speaking more languages is a socio-cultural asset with economic dimensions. Every language is a worthy component of the asset. This asset is enviable by those who as a community or a nation speak only one language, generation after generation. To let the child gain the asset during the period of early childhood is within the control of the parents who themselves have so gained. When the period of childhood is over, and if the child has not been let to gain the asset in the family in continuation of the legacy, a crime will have been committed against the child by no others than his own parents. The child, when adult, will have no legacy of competitiveness in languages to pass on. The child will remember the parents, not kindly, for this thoughtless and myopic omission or, worse still, parental negligence. Chapter 4. Touch and tie the child. An Indian mother sits on the floor with her legs stretched close together. She lays her baby on her lap with its head resting on her knees. And the exercise or ritual of massaging and caressing of the entire body of the baby begins with a liberal use of oil, abundant manifestation of affection and derivation of pleasure, and this goes on and on. She never seems to tire while the oil lasts, though no spot has been missed. The baby responds to the caressing and cooing by the mother by purring like a kitten who has its neck tickled. This is a common scene in homes in India and Pakistan, and was so in East Africa too. Whether the traditional massage with religious regularity during the infancy is a culture or a healthcare or both, the distinct significance and effect of the mother's touch and caress on the baby cannot be underestimated. I would call the culture touch and tie, for it is believed to have the effect of tying the baby subconsciously in devotion and loyalty towards the mother and the family for manifestation prominently later in his adult life. Touch and caress. It should not be viewed as surprising if some of the small children in an orphanage are on occasions seen leaving their separate beds at night to join others asleep in their separate beds. The touch of legs or hands provides the satisfaction of human warmth and a sense of security when the touch and caress from their mothers are missing. Reportedly, patients in hospitals appear to be closer and warmer to their physiotherapists than their general physicians whose services, on the other hand, are even more important to them. The spell of quality life a person has is during the infancy period of touch and caress at the time of breastfeeding without, however, being able to realize or quantify the benefits of its effect on his adult life later. Fortunately, no one normally misses the spell. What can be missing is a complementary benefit from the touch and caress through massaging during that period. Oil massage is messy, of course, to that mother who is unprepared for it, and so is cooking, but then the family needs affection and loyalty as much as the daily food. How interesting! Is it not the mutual affection and loyalty within the family which also ensures the provision of daily food for all in the family? Chapter 5. Let the child be a child. A child was visited at home by his friend. That night the child declined to sleep in his room. He insisted on joining the parents in their bedroom. The fear of his room was triggered when the friend asked the child if he was not afraid to sleep so close to a window when ghosts and spirits peep directly into the room. The tactful approach to the situation should have been for the parents to accede to what the child had pleaded for, at least, for that night, knowing that such fears were off or become much less the next day. Instead, they thought it a good opportunity to enforce the parental discipline over the child so that he abandons what was perceived as a sissy trait. The parents, after a peaceful sleep with no sense of guilt, woke up in the morning fully pleased with the result of their putting the foot down. And they would not ask the child how he slept, because that would have undermined the disciplinary strategy of the night. Indeed, why? Needless to say, the child was restless that night because he was a human child, and if only the parents knew that. Why believe in a ghost or spirit when you have seen none and will see none of them ever in your life? The father's argument kept ringing in the child's ears, and he would ask himself, indeed why? The child was betraying nothing more than a simple natural fear of an unseen, never seen before, because he, as human, has been created, in the nature of readily believing in the unseen, that unseen which basically includes Allah, angels, jinnat, spirits, and shaitan, Satan. No wonder that the fundamental teaching in Islam is al-iman bil-ghaib, that is, the belief in the unseen. Verse 2-3. Therefore, the human nature makes a woodcutter instinctively cry out when his axe accidentally falls sharply on his foot, though he is all alone in the forest. The instinct in its reflex response makes him, the created, to cry out to his creator, the unseen. Fear mental normalcy. The subject of al-ghaib reveals one thoughtful aspect for discussion here. Fear? It is part of the instinct for self-preservation or survival. It is not something that a child can be made ashamed of. In fact, manifestation of fear is a welcome sign of a mental normalcy in him. The parents should instead keep the mind of the child at rest by making a joke of their own past embarrassment over false fears, or by cracking a few jokes on themselves on the subject. To ask the child to banish fear is like asking him to banish his human instinct. Remember the woodcutter. Was his piercing cry of moan in the lonely forest a waste? No. It immediately comforted him in his pain. The instinct of seeking out the unseen with a cry of moan comes as an immediate relief to all of us. But we do not pause to ponder. It is said that fear as part of the human instinct begins even before a baby is born. Some pregnant mothers are reported to have noticed that a sudden loud noise or a sudden let go heavily onto the couch produced distinct signs of disturbance in the baby in the womb, akin to the signs of fear. Fear in children. Let us conclude the discussion by the comments on the following quotation from a good authority on the natural aspect of fear in the children. Another characteristic of the child's personality is the presence of many fears. These fears result from uncertainty combined with easy recourse to imagination. The imagination runs toward superlatives, and when a child indulges in fantasy, things are either very attractive or very threatening. We can ascribe a reason for this in the context of Islam. Imagination by the child or his fantasy is a phase of manifestation of his attempt at perceiving things which are and remain unseen. The child's negative fear of the worst because it is caused by his uncertain of an unseen like ghost and spirit itself indicates one important thing: the existence of the natural positive capacity also for submission to the best, that is, his creator, in the realm of the unseen, because it is derived from certainty, which is al-iman bil-ghaib. So let the child be a child under the dictates of a child's nature while he as a child gropes in the dark for light, that is, knowledge leading to faith. And then conviction, which he attains one after the other regarding the unseen later in his adult life. Chapter 6. Spare the child from inferiority complex. A young person enters a crowded mosque or imam baga through the front door. A sermon or preaching is going on. Believing that all eyes are on him, he unconsciously touches his nose once or twice with his hand before he finds a place. This is not an inferiority complex, only shyness, that type which shows. While shyness is an embarrassment if there is awareness that it shows, an inferiority complex is an agony. It is not fairly easy to adjust to if it begins in childhood, mostly cultivated in the child by the parents unknowingly. It affects the personal the child when an adult. It is only fair that parents are advised in detail on the subject, which is known generally more by its name than substance. The length of discussion will necessitate presentation to be in three separate parts. The complex in a person is not as much a feeling of inferiority or seeing oneself small as believing that others see him so. This belief is not always true. It take a form of an obsession in rare cases if the condition is severe originating childhood. Flattered. Let us consider one example. A boy is flattered when a group of older boys engaged in smoking, and to him they are an elite group, because not many of that age e-cigarettes favors him with a few puffs the first spell in his life, and he tries to suppress the bouts of coughing attendant with nausea. He finds himself a happy boy without having to tolerate any more puffs. But then, the elite group who exhibit the supposed manhood personality will see him as inferior to them. This presumption braves him for more spells of smoking to set him on the path of habitual smoking. As no sane person is perfectly and fully sane, no person is also fully or entirely free from the condition under discussion. However, the condition becomes a complex and known as such only when it exceeds the normal level in a person. The feeling of being small is natural and right with a small child when he finds himself truly so in size in the family. The family is his only world and the father the only hero he idolizes. So he likes to imitate the behavior and actions of his father, girl with those of the mother, as his model, hero, to counter the feeling of being small and to impress himself and others in the family that he is catching up with his model in behavior and actions, if not in size. A tale of slippers. Let us consider a pertinent example. The father with severe coughing is alarmed to find that his small child has also started coughing. He is not only relieved but also amused when assured by the doctor that the child was imitating him, and what a natural actor for his age. Another example, the small child clumsily walks with a pair of father's slippers on, and often loses balance. The family, seeing his interest and labor in the use of slippers, buy him a pair of his size which he uses for an hour or longer until the novelty of the new slippers, like a new toy, wears off. Then the child ignores the pair of his comfortable size and resumes the use of his father's, because it is not the slippers which are the point of focus for him. The child therefore expects from the parents nothing less than an affectionate acknowledgement and approval of his single-minded adoration of the parents and imitation of their behavior. He, equipped by his own trust in himself, trusts them. With such a position of trust, however, it is often the parents who can cause unknowingly the rise in the condition gradually and steadily in the child above the normal level and place the first fateful layer as the base for an inferiority complex. Once this occurs, the base then attracts a pile-up of more layers, one after the other, from outside the home in school, sports ground, in meetings, debate, and the ugly edifice of the complex will have been raised. Normally it is not possible for the parents or others to detect the condition in a person nor attribute any particular behavior of the moment to the influence of the complex. What is worse is that the person who undergoes the nagging belief that he is being seen small or unimportant also believes that the condition is normal with others too, as victims in the society. Sajda, prostration. However, the condition varies from person to person in traits and also in degrees, that is, in the number of layers, among those who are subject. Those who grow learning not to attach undue importance to the glitters of this transient world, instead cultivate the conviction of a better life in the hereafter, other persons can very well adjust themselves in their adult life and wear off the condition. Sajda, if its significance is well understood, can, for example, serve as an antidote. The face, the best visible part of the body is brought down to the lowest level possible where the leg, accustomed to dirt, tread, and then intoned is the moving testimony, that all glory to my Lord only the exalted while all other human beings, his slaves are lowly and insignificant, except for what he bestows on them out his grace. No wonder, there appears no inclination to lift up the face from the spiritually soothing posture of sajda, but then for every next sajda the head has to be once again. The Bible too mentions about the sajda practiced by the previous prophets appropriate occasions. How surprising that a person of whatever station of life see through his profound humbleness to his Lord enjoy a sense of superiority in the society in that respect and dictate values in his relation with others on the position strength derived from that humbleness. The nearest position of man's servitude, a bondsman, to Allah is when he is in the state of prostration, sajda, hadith of the Prophet Muhammad peace be upon him and his progeny. And then, the Holy Quran also repeatedly questions us if we, the mortals, have traversed the earth and seen what have remained of those in the past who thought themselves to be mighty and everlasting, and sensed themselves superior in material terms during their time of pomp in this life. Behavioral traits. Caution, the few examples of various shades of the complex catalogued herein from such broad general experience as is common in the society. They have been framed only to illustrate the fluid nature of the behavioral traits. Important. It is important to gain the right perspective of the subject under discussion through the Islamic point of view, which is as follows: a human being rightly senses his self-importance, but he fails to realize that the feeling originates subconsciously from the fact that the nature in which he has been created acknowledges that he is the most dignified as a member of mankind among other creatures, Ashraful Makhluqah, and that too created by the best of the creators, Izzan al-Khalikin. However, the mistake man does is by wanting to relate his self-importance to the human assessment, that is, how best the society sees him, and not in his relation to his creator as to how best he judges him. Therefore, a complex of inferiority or a sense of superiority on the basis of a human judgment indicates a serious weakness of faith if observed in a Muslim. Small children being human are no different from adults. They too by nature are concerned with their shades of self-importance. Their family being the only world they know, they too are made to feel concerned as to how their parents judge them. They are sensitive to a negative judgment. Their reaction is however different from that of adults when they become a subject of an inferiority complex. The catalogue of examples. Let us examine first the examples of the traits in adults. There are those among adults who adjust themselves by adopting an introvert approach of moving among the close circles they have known for years. They would not venture into new, unknown or larger circles of people. But then there are also those who are extrovert in approach and engross themselves in countering the condition by trying to attract attention to themselves and register their importance on others. Frankly, there are no reasons for having to do any of these. To attract attention to oneself or to want to register one's importance on others is normal, if it is within reasons and up to a point. For example, this is common with a younger person who is flattered to be in a company of the people older in age and among them, perhaps many with new or distinguished faces. It is, however, not normal where a person betrays the following traits, as examples only, in his behavior while in a company of people or at meetings. He pays little attention to the chain of discussion going on because his mind is engaged in wanting to create an opportunity of saying something, or he would abruptly interrupt to introduce a new subject of his liking, or he would drop names of important persons known to him while there is no direct relevance to the discussion. All these are in the attempt to impress his importance so that he is not seen small or a person of little importance, which he wrongly thinks he is seen. For more examples, the subject purportedly reveals solemnly an important and sensitive information, which is exaggerated, if not false, or he publicizes a small honor done to him by complaining that he did not deserve it but was pressed into accepting it, or raises the same small or petty argument, long forgotten, to renew his lame defense. Or goes on defending his opinion or judgment though he knows that it is glaringly wrong, What is worse? He misinterprets good intentions towards him. Or he makes a mountain out of a molehill, when he is offended unintentionally, or his is a lone opposition to a proposal, which is favored by a large consensus in a meeting, without an alternative suggestion from him, because what is important to him, is that he spoke without being seen to toe the lines of those in large majority, whom he perceives falsely as elite or superior to him. A combination of any of such behaviors with a degree 7, of consistency indicates the telltale signs of the condition which is above normal, the complex of inferiority. An earring. One more trait which is prevalent among young persons who are affected is to borrow from the reflective celebrities, like musicians, actors, sportsmen, and proudly bask under their infectious reflection. They do so by imitating the trends set by them in the fashion of clothes, greetings, walking gait or any aspect of face, or one ear, adornment, or haircut, however peculiar or unconventional they may be for males in the society. They attempt to borrow from the reflection of the importance of others because they see themselves or believe that others see them as lacking in their own individual importance, self-identity. Imagine a cricketer, a hero himself to the millions of cricket fans, revealing such a weak personality. This may be a sign that the complex originating from his childhood has yet to wear off, if it ever will. Precautions at home. Your child returns home seething and mumbling a complaint incoherently. You touch his hand as a sign of assurance of your concern and love for him so that he opens up, and this angers him further to worsen the situation. There can be a valid reason for this, and yet there can also be one which is not. It may be connected with a complex of inferiority. There are a number of precautions which parents need to take so as not to cultivate an inferiority complex in the child. The most important one is for the parents or any member in the family not to make a sneering reference to any negative aspect of the child's appearance, complexion or physical handicap, which unfortunately is the tendency of a father. To do so in the moments of anger over any incident of misbehavior by the child. It is vicious when the child is a girl and if it comes from the father, arid worse still, if this is occasioned in the presence of his siblings or friends. There is no such thing as an ideal or perfect human appearance. Monkeys ask among themselves, is it the ugly face which gives a human being so much brain? And that may not be all. Some crawling species of insects are rarely trampled upon unaware because human beings are believed to smell horrible, even from distance. Perhaps, the human speech sounds most irritating to some animals, music perhaps even worse. When a child who is so viciously subjected to this indignity at the hands of his parents meets other students on his day of enrollment in the school, instead of eyeing the competitive possessions of each other's, like multicolored pencils, books with flashy covers or even toys brought stealthily from home, the poor soul appraises the shape and size of their ears, to see if any pair was matching his as a solace. His has to be worse anyway because his father sees it so and says it. Agony of funny name. Such a child normally for want of sympathy at a child's level. Feels inclined to confide to his new deskmate the agony of the funny name by which he is teased at home because of, say, the shape of his ears or nose or head or the wide gap in a front row of teeth. What follows next is that he becomes known by that very name in the school in a matter of days only to worsen the agony which is likely to result into a fateful distaste by the child towards the school and the consequent poor performances in his entire school life. Parents should also desist from scolding or insulting or punishing the child in the presence of others, especially his friends, worse, if the practice is during the meal's time in the presence of the siblings. Apart from making him feel small, he may reply back only to defend his ego, self-respect, in their presence and thus create a precedent for such regular encounters in future also. Besides, the right of the parents to lecture the child over a bad performance becomes only due if they have the fairness of commending and praising him also for a good performance as and when the occasions arise. And when it comes to lecturing him on his poor performances, his should never be compared with the performances of others by names, among his friends, relatives or neighbors, to make him feel distinctly small. He will believe that they too see him as small and worthless, as this judgment comes from his parents. It will be disastrous if he resigns to it as being a fact and that which he thinks is irreversible. Acting like a boss. On the contrary, whatever the ups and downs in the child's graph of performances, he should be encouraged to invite friends home and allowed the laxity or latitude of acting like a boss of the house in their presence, so as to assist him to build up a good commanding image of himself to impress the friends. This boosts personality. He will talk about each such occasion for hours after the friends have left. Parents should restrain themselves from revealing, jovially or in frustration, to others outside the family, any of the child's behaviors and habits which are no credit to him. Bedwetting, obsessive fears, say, of insects or darkness, hand feeding, etc. are examples. The family's friends and neighbors and their children may take the liberty to tease the child in public. The conditions are temporary and wear off, but the teasing in public persists. The child should be protected by the same restraint which the parents exercise to protect each other's own bad habits from the public knowledge. And then, the parents should also avoid quarreling among themselves in the presence of the child. The family is his world and the parents are his only heroes, role models, in his world. The scenes of quarrels will demolish his perception of his nice world, and his good image of the parents. He would look elsewhere outside his home for a better hero to idolize and imitate. The result will be the pin-up pictures of the celebrities pasted on the walls, dangling of a cigarette from a side of the lips while looking into a mirror, an earring in an ear, a peculiar haircut. Baggy or drain pipe trousers or the pair with multicolored patches, which all are the signs of borrowing self-importance from the reflection of the importance of others, when his own is made to appear lacking or shallow. Children shoot schoolmates. The incidents of children shooting down fellow students in the schools are horrible, but not quite inexplicable. The former are most likely the victims of the inferiority complex in a society which believes in an unrestricted freedom for children. The recent, March 2001, examples are the separate shooting in two high schools in California. The teenage gunman in one was said to be unpopular among the students. In another incident, 15 people were killed by a student in a Colorado high school in April, 1999. The child, agonized by false perception of his unpopularity in the school, reacts abnormally to make himself truly unpopular. He is seen at home moody, rebellious, depressed or brooding. The unmistakable telltale sign is his outburst strangely against the parents at their expression of love or concern. A gun is the means for a sudden command over power and assertion of his importance over others. The newspaper's headlines will flash his name. The TV media will beam his pictures. He will have accomplished what no one among his peers or any in the elite group could dare. He too is important. He will have the last laugh. Effectiveness of Sajda. So if the child returns home badly upset and complains falsely over what appears to be his ego having been offended, which is a satanic trait, get him to perform a quick sajda and teach him to tell himself while in a sajda the fact that he and all others who ever walked on this earth are small and unimportant before Allah, and that he is the greater than them because he knows that fact. How Allah sees and judges him is all that he cares for. Perhaps by this way, the parents may undo whatever they may have done in laying the foundation for the child's complex at home. The understanding of the significance of sajda is normally minimal to a child, but it has its impact to last him during his adult life. Firstly, he will remember his childhood experience of sajda, which he will always connect to the false feeling or perception of being small in a society. Mind always needs a trigger for strength, and what can be a better one than sajda in pertinence to the subject? Secondly, it will serve to register in his mind that an inferiority complex arises in a person who is weak in mind and faith. However, the effectiveness of sajda during childhood depends on the child seeing the parents also in sajda while they are performing their salah regularly. And then the importance of regular supplications, dua, to Allah for guidance in raising a good, salih, child with a stable mind and strong faith, should never be underrated.